Hi, welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We get out of the studio and onto the road to find the kind of radio you don't hear so much anymore. Stories off the beaten path and usually away from the top headlines. We figure the weekend is a good time for that. Time to lean back a little, slow down, meet somebody interesting, hear what people are saying. Of course, when we're not on the radio, you can catch up with us on Facebook. Just search Indiana Weekend. And we'd love to hear your thoughts about the show, your comments, thoughts about whom we might talk with, or where you would like to hear our microphones. Our email address is, conveniently enough, indianaweekend@gmail.com. I'm John Strauss. Today on Indiana Weekend, is there anything in Indiana as famous, you know, the subject of song and sentiment, quite like the Wabash River? When I dream about the moonlight on the Wabash. Well, so maybe it's no surprise that several environmental and arts groups, starting in Terre Haute, have gotten together to designate 2013 as the Year of the River. They're hoping other communities along the Wabash will join in and come up with their own programs to call attention to the river. The Wabash is part of a Healthy Rivers initiative sponsored by the Indiana Department of Natural Resources and the Nature Conservancy, who are highlighting conservation efforts. The Wabash's floodplain was set aside in 2010 as a protected wildlife corridor. The Year of the River doesn't begin for another few months, but the organizers, including Mary Kramer of Terre Haute, are hard at work already. Mary joined us on the phone.
There are plays, there are exhibits, there are duck races, there are cleanup efforts that will take place. There's the Vigo County Public Library is doing Tom Sawyer for their big read, so there will be a lot of events around that the library is doing. The Historical Society will do some projects. It's all kinds of events focused on the river. And one of the ideas behind this is to help connect people in Terre Haute back to the river, which is, you know, right by our city, but it's, you know, we've gotten a little separated from it. And so along with a lot of other organizations that have been focused on development ideas and the Wabashiki fish and wildlife area that was recently established across the river and trails and recreational facilities along the river, we are just trying to excite people about reconnecting to it.
What do you think our feeling is about the Wabash River now, just as a state?
I think it's increasing in importance. The governor has, along with other organizations, has established the Healthy Rivers Initiative. And I know that the wetlands that we have reestablished here, which is called the Wabashiki Fish and Wildlife Area, is 2,400 acres right now. And there's effort being made and considerable progress in this of purchasing and or preserving another, I think it's 43,000 acres north and south along the Wabash. So it will be a huge tract of undisturbed land.
What was the Wabash's role in Indiana's history? I mean, you had Indian nations along its banks. It was the route for trade, exploration.
Well, it was. And, you know, I'm not a historian, but I will say certainly the civilizations that lived along it knew how fertile the ground was around it and how important it was to their livelihood. You know, at times there was a lot more traffic up and down, trade up and down the river. We've really gotten away from that. And while there may not be trade that goes up and down the river, there's a lot of other ways in which the Wabash is going to remain important to the state. And, you know, if you think about it, rivers are kind of the lifeblood of any state. I mean, it's where a lot of our water comes from. If not directly from the river, it comes from the watershed around the river. And so what our project is doing is looking at the whole watershed. You know, we're trying to involve people that are working with projects that aren't just focused on the Wabash River, but the watershed and all the other tributaries that feed into it. And we've gotten a good response from about 50 different organizations so far that are going to be involved.
Rivers have almost a mystical quality to them for some people.
Well, they do. And, you know, one of the things I can say is that the name Wabash came from the word Wabashiki, which has to do with the Indian word for seeing white at the bottom of the river, so that, you know, one would think it was a clearer river at the time. I know you know, there's been a lot of cleanup effort done, and it's a lot cleaner than it used to be. But I like to think of that as an inspiration for, you know, the vision of the river when it was more pristine and so important to the livelihood of people. And we're just really excited. It's a great opportunity for art spaces to bring in some artists. We'll be bringing in some artists that are focusing on ecology and art and ways of combining those
Mary
things.
Mary Kramer,
to
Executive Director of Art Spaces, Inc. in Terre
so
Haute,
for us it's
and
a
one
great
of the organizers of
that.
The Year of the River in 2013, focusing attention on the Wabash River.
Indiana Weekend, real radio from just down the road. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line to let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com. Here's John Strauss.
And on the show from time to time, we just talk with regular people about what's going on with them. Nurse Amy is here. Amy, what's going on?
Well, actually, right now, I've been trying to work with my grandparents. We're getting to the point in their lives where they need to go to what I think a different facility, physically and emotionally, financially. It's been hard for them to keep their home, so I've been working on that. It's been pretty busy trying to get the resources and that kind of thing that we need, but we think we've come to a conclusion, so that's what I've been doing.
Fair to call you, are you a baby boomer, or are you a Generation X, or what would you say you are?
I'm a baby boomer.
Yeah. And I think millions of people are coming. Don't you get the sense? I'll bet when you talk with your friends, they're going through the same kinds of things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Our parents are obviously getting older, and they need help, and we've got our kids still at home, so we're kind of right in the middle. We're sandwiched in there.
Well, about what age group are your grandparents in?
They're in their 80s.
Okay. And they're still doing pretty well, or what's their situation like?
Yes. My grandfather has some health issues, and so that's part of the reason. I mean, they just can't take care of their lawn, their house, and that kind of thing like they used to anymore. So my grandmother is in pretty good health physically. Mentally, you know, she's starting to fail just a little bit, but, you know, she's in her 80s, so that's pretty typical.
And how do you see that? Is it a matter of people forgetting an appointment here and there, or?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Forgetting things, forgetting they've told you certain things, you know, repeating stories and that kind of thing. So, but, you know, like I said, that's fairly normal, I think, for that age group.
And when you talk with your friends, they're also experiencing this sort of thing. And part of it is that sometimes living arrangements need to change. How do you have those conversations with your parents or your grandparents?
In our situation, my grandfather was hospitalized during the winter, and the doctors kind of brought up a little bit about it then. So that was a good opening for us, and how they would handle that when the summer came, as far as facilitating just everyday things in a home that, as we all know, requires a lot of work. And so that's how it kind of opened up. We opened it up back then, probably January, February, and then really started to be more aggressive as, you know, summer came on, and as, you know, we had a great spring. So their lawn really needed care, and they just couldn't physically do it. And we are a small distance from them. We're an hour away. So we really needed something here that they could be close to us.
Was driving an issue? Did they have to stop driving, or are they still doing that? Or
my grandmother does not drive. My grandfather still drives some, but that is a very difficult thing for people of this age. I know someone, a good friend of mine, it got to the point where they had to put a lock on the steering wheel, her father's steering wheel, just because he was being dangerous, not only to himself, but to other people. But they want to remain independent as long as they can. But when it comes to a point where they're endangering other people, that's when you really have to step in.
Are there people out there who can give you good advice on this? I mean, as you've kind of worked around these things, are you finding good information?
Yes. You know, obviously the internet is full of information, but the sites that are really have been helpful to me are eldercare.com. It has a wealth of information about housing and just any resource that you might need for your loved one. The other one is ARP, which, you know, elderly people generally are very familiar with. It also has a lot of resources. Also the VA, if your parents or grandparents, whatever, have ever been involved in the military, that's also a good source. There is some financial gain that you can get if you need to get into like an assisted living facility for the person who is active military or the spouse. And a lot of people that are in their 70s and 80s have had some stint sometimes in the military, and it's free money that a lot of elderly people don't know about.
As you work through this, is it harder when you're particularly close with your grandparents?
It's very difficult, to be honest, because, you know, they've been your parents, your grandparents, they've showed you the way, and now they're failing, and you've got to show them the way. And that is a hard position to be in. You want them to regain their independence as much as possible, and make them as happy as possible in these last few years.
There probably comes kind of a turning point, or maybe a series of those where you go, well, you know, we're going to have to do something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the turning points are generally when you've come to the end of the road physically, where they cannot handle things anymore, or mentally for that reason. And it is something you really don't want to deal with at that time. You know, we all have busy lives. We all have things going on. But unfortunately, it's something you have to deal with. You have to deal with it. Because, you know, they endanger themselves being at home in those situations, and you just have to take over, almost similar to them being your children, to be honest.
Does it help that you have some friends who are going through this? It's almost some support from your peers?
I have a couple of friends at work, and they have went through very similar situations. And they were very resourceful for me also, and also emotional help, just saying, hey, you know, you can't take things personally. Because sometimes, like children, they're upset with you because they're going through this. And you just can't take things personally. It's just what it is, to be honest.
It's what's going on with Amy. Thanks, Amy, for sharing that with us. I mean, I think there are other people who might be thinking about this and hearing your words. Maybe they'll get an idea of reaching out for some help.
Yeah. Anytime, John. Thanks so much.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend, John Strauss with you, talking with Jerry Romine, who does motorcycle safety training for Abate. Do I have that right? Am I saying that right?
Yes, Abate of Indiana.
Okay, and we're in your trailer here. We're looking at one of your motorcycles that you train people on. And what's the hardest thing for new riders to learn, would you say?
To give themselves a break and not be so hard on themselves.
What does that mean?
A lot of people come in that have never ridden, they're nervous, and they think any little thing they do wrong is bad, and it upsets them, and it's harder to get them to calm down and concentrate on what we're doing than it is to show them what it is we want them to do.
What are a couple of the things that people who may be already riding not realize that they need to know to ride a bike safely?
The proper way to go through a curve. It's become one of the largest killers of motorcyclists in the country. And we also teach emergency braking and emergency swerving. So it's not just a class that is just a beginner to get you rolling down the road on a motorcycle. We actually teach some advanced skills in the class.
Anybody ever fail your course?
Oh, yes.
You're smiling.
Well, the fact is, a lot of people would like to believe that you come up here, you pay your money, and we give you cards that say you passed the course. We don't. You come up here, you pay your money, you take the course, you prove to us that you can do what you have to do, then you get your cards. I had a couple come up one time, a married couple. The wife had never been on a motorcycle. The husband told me he knew all about it because he'd ridden for years. The wife went home with her cards, and the husband went home with a bad attitude because he didn't graduate.
What was his problem?
He knew everything there was to know about riding a motorcycle, and when we would correct him on something, he'd go, well, that's not the way I do it. And I'd say, well, okay, it's not the way you do it now, but it's the way you need to do it to get through this. Well, that's not the way I do it. The wife, on the other hand, having never been on one, took us at our word, and she did what we asked her and what we showed her. And at the end of the course, she went home very happy, and he went home very upset.
What's the most common kind of accident that we see with motorcyclists?
There are two forms of The most common one is somebody pulling out in front of a motorcyclist because they say they don't see him. Or, as I said before, a motorcyclist just not knowing the proper way to go through a curve.
What do you mean by that, the proper way to go through a curve? We're used to just, we drive down the road and here comes a curve, we turn the wheel. It's a little different?
It's much different on a motorcycle. We use what's called the slow look, press, and roll. And it's a four-step system for taking a curve on a motorcycle. The best way to describe it is getting yourself set up to take a curve safely.
What kind of advice do you give to people who may be thinking about buying a motorcycle for the first time?
Find a motorcycle that will fit you. And second of all, get yourself signed up for an Abbey motorcycle class.
Okay, let's assume that they're going to get training. When you say a motorcycle that fits you, one that's not too large or too heavy? Or...
Well, a lot of people think that a motorcycle is too large because of the engine size. It's not the engine size so much as it is the way the bike fits you. Once you've had the motorcycle safety class, engine size becomes a lot less of a problem. It's how the bike fits you. Can you sit on it? Can you reach the ground flat-footed? Can you handle the weight of it safely?
What kind of things do you see among the students when they first come to you, the kinds of things that they do that make you glad that they're taking your course?
Looking down instead of looking up, just nerves is a lot of it, just getting over being nervous about being on a motorcycle for the first time.
Something I think I've noticed is on the other end of the scale, some people who are out riding bikes who seem to have no fear at all and are driving at high speed and in and out of traffic. What do you think when you see that?
Well, I've been a believer for many years that when you quit being a little afraid of your motorcycle, it's time to get off of it. If you don't respect the motorcycle and what can happen with it, then you don't need to be out there.
Tell me a story of your own riding experience about where your safety training and knowledge came in handy and saved you.
Deer are a big problem in Indiana, and the problem with deer is you never know where they're going to go. And one of the things we talk about in class is what to do when you spot deer, and many, many times I've had to use the skills I've learned actually taking the class to avoid a deer or a dog or something like that.
I never even thought of that. But when you see those signs that say, you know, deer in the area, if you're on a bike especially, you really have to be mindful of that.
I don't care where you are in Indiana, you need to be mindful of it. I've chased deer off of the range.
Off of your training range
off
here at this at this middle school parking lot.
I came up one morning to set up for class and chased three of them off the range on the motorcycle. So I don't care where you're at in Indiana, there's a white-tailed deer somewhere around.
That's Jerry Romine, site coordinator in Muncie for the Abate Motorcycle Safety Course. Details at abateofindiana.org.
I don't want a pickle. Just want to ride my motorcycle. And I don't want a tickle. I'd rather ride my motorcycle. And I don't want to die. I just want to ride my motorcycle.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.
It's nice every once in a while to get outside the studio, sit under a tree, maybe do a little thinking. Here's what I've been thinking about. Every once in a while, we get a wake-up call. Something reminds us just how lucky we are, how close we came to disaster, maybe. A reminder that we shouldn't take good luck for granted. Are you a lucky person? If you think you are, that might be a piece of luck itself. Turns out, if you believe in good luck, you're more likely to be optimistic and more satisfied with your life. That's from a study published in 2008. You may not know if you're lucky or not. It may just depend on what day we're talking about. Suppose you're at an intersection. You don't know it, but an accident is about to happen. That's possible, right? Accidents happen all the time. Fourth leading cause of death in the United States. You know what number one is? Here's a hint. Try the low-fat salad dressing and get your exercise. Anyway, here you are at this intersection. There's a left turn to get onto the interstate, and there are two left turn lanes onto that entrance ramp. You want to be in the left lane or the right lane? Pick one and remember that. Now there's a car in each of these lanes, yours and somebody else's. I guess the question, are you lucky, means, do you get more than your share of good luck? if you do, is that really good luck or good probability? Kind of post hoc meets the gambler's fallacy. I think it's a little bit of both. Here's why, and let's take car wrecks. According to the Census National Data Book, we get into about 11 million car accidents per year. By far, most of those don't result in fatalities, but even so, your risk of, well, buying the farm is still 1 in 100. Doesn't sound like much. It's 71 times as likely as a plane crash. It's fourth only behind heart disease, cancer, and stroke. So get healthy while you still can. I don't want to be morbid. There's some good news. In Indiana and nationally, traffic fatalities are now half what they were in 1990. Our fatality rate is the same as three of our four surrounding states. The fourth, nearly twice as large as ours. I'll tell you which one in a minute. So anyway, feeling lucky today? Let's get back to our example. I was driving back from an Indiana weekend assignment the other day. I was at a busy intersection in Indianapolis. This is one of those intersections in which you turn left to get onto the interstate. Two lanes turn left, so you decide if you're going to be in the left lane or the right. Which lane would you pick? I picked the left lane. Hey, I'm left-handed. So there's a car next to me in the right lane. The light changes. We pull into the intersection. Then there's a screaming screech of brakes. A car has blown the stoplight and slams into the car next to me, the car that was in the right lane. I wasn't touched. Still don't know how. I guess you could say I'm a lucky person most days. Of course, that can change. Calamity is really just around the corner. Maybe luck on any given day just means it wasn't your time, that time. That could be in Indiana or down in Kentucky, which has twice our traffic fatality rate. The difference today is we don't have to rely on being lucky. We drive a little slower, eliminate distractions. Health-wise, we take it easy at the dinner table, take a walk each day, or find some other way to get healthy. Or as Samuel Goldwyn once said about good fortune, the harder I work, the luckier I get. After all, you only get so much good luck. The rest is just statistics.
That's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Marcus Jackman. Glad you could join us this time and hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you would like more information or have a suggestion. Reminder that we also need your stories, your ideas for places we should go and people we should talk to. Some of those are coming in and we'll be heading out to some of those. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio, I'm John Strauss.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss of the Ball State Journalism Department. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Marcus Jackman. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from Dillman's Furniture, Muncie, serving East Central Indiana with home furnishings from Flex Steel, Bassett, and Simmons Beautyrest. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.